Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Welcome to another edition of Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and on this week's show, myself and Rebecca Watson are in conversation with Cory Doctorow. Cory Doctorow is a science fiction novelist, blogger, and technology activist. He is the co-editor of the popular weblog Boing Boing, and a contributor to Wired, The Guardian, Popular Science, The New York Times, and many other newspapers, magazines, and websites. A visiting senior lecturer at the Open University, he was formerly Director of European Affairs for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a non-profit civil liberties group that defends freedom in technology law, policy, standards and treaties. He is currently on the Advisory Council of the Open Rights Group. Cory's novels are published by HarperCollins UK and simultaneously released on the internet under Creative Commons licenses that encourage their reuse and sharing. He has won the Locus and Sunburst Awards and has been nominated for the Hugo, Nebula and British Science Fiction Awards. His latest novel is Makers, and his last, the New York Times bestseller Little Brother, was published in May 2008. A new young adult novel, For the Win, will be published in May 2010.
Cory Doctorow, thank you very much for joining us on Little Atoms.
My pleasure.
We are sitting in a remarkable office full of kitsch and steampunk and... It looks like everything you've collected over the past 30 years?
Everything I've kept out of everything I've collected over the last 30 years, that's right.
Right. Do you feel that surrounding yourself with such creative stuff helps you in your writing process?
I guess so, a little bit. I always love those old Ray Bradbury Presents TV shows where they open it with a shot of his office of the dinosaurs and rocket ship. I'm Ray Bradbury, master of imagination! You know, and you'd see him typing away at, you know, his paleo typewriter. And yeah, physical culture is, you know, if you're going to write about technology, having a lot of technology around, which, you know, I take a very broad view and include things like books as technology. You know, I have that piano roll up there that's the, you know, the first ever contested digital file format that led to the first big copyright fight, you know, in the early part of the 20th century in America, and John Philip Sousa saying the infernal talking machines would rob Americans of their voice boxes as monkeys lost their tails when they came out of the trees and so on. So yeah, I like having this stuff around. It's kind of, some of it's like a memento mori, like a poet keeping a skull on his desk, you know? And some of it's inspiration too, like those 3D printed math sculptures there that came on top of that hollow book that I keep my office supplies in. And then there's, sorry, I'm getting away from your mic, but these are... museum replicas that were 3D printed at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto. So they were scanned and printed from their collection.
Oh, wow.
In epoxy.
That's
pretty cool.
Although our listeners can't see these things, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well,
we'll take pictures.
Camera running. And then there's this, which is also a very telling artifact. That's a 200,000-year-old axe head. And the interesting thing about it is the shop that I bought it in also had 300,000-year-old axe heads that looked just the same. So there was a period of 100,000 years during which the state of the art didn't budge, right? I mean, that to me is actually one of the most important technological lessons that you can learn, is that what we think of as the inevitable progress actually doesn't necessarily always take place.
But the real question is, was there a price difference?
I don't remember. Maybe there must have been. I think they had them in a lot of different sizes, which weren't specific to the era. They just, I guess, people who made axe heads 300,000 years ago used whatever was lying around. And I think I picked that one because it would fit in my suitcase.
Well, obviously, technology advances a little faster these days.
Uh-huh.
And we were just talking on the way, and particularly in reference to Little Brother, and you just mentioned that you write about technology. Does it matter to you in that writing process that technology inevitably dates? So stuff that you're writing about now will be, especially the subject matter you write about, will be obsolete within a couple of years?
Yeah, no, not at all, because I'm not trying to predict the future. I think at best I'm trying to predict the present, which is to say I'm trying to use the device of futurism to tell stories about how technology today is invisibly and pervasively changing society and vice versa. And, you know, I think the easiest way to do that is to have that device, is to have that funhouse mirror. You know, I don't think Mary Shelley was upset that, you know, no one ever figured out how to animate dead people. I think that, you know, her science fiction stands up very well as a cautionary tale about what happens when technology becomes your master instead of your servant, much more than it would have done if she tried to accurately gauge where the future of, you know, lightning animated dead people was going, you know.
And on that point, you know, speaking of Little Brother being more of a dystopian present almost, mm-hmm. I found it really interesting. I was just reading it yesterday actually, and noting that you open talking about school laptops that schools use to spy on the kids with, and it struck me as really odd that just in February in a Philly suburb they found that laptops given to students, they had webcams on them. Those webcams were being used to literally spy on what the kids were doing outside of school. Mm-hmm. Do you ever feel that, you know, the things you're writing almost don't even go far enough?
Well, I mean, there's a perfect example of predicting the present. I mean, you know, the No Child Left Behind Act in the United States mandates network-level filtering on schools and libraries that receive federal funding in the U.S., and a bunch of other stuff that we've chipped away at with a series of constitutional lawsuits. But this particular mandate has meant that the norm for school computing has been that there's some spyware on them, that there's spyware at the network level and sometimes at the device level to see what you're clicking on and make sure it's nothing naughty. And the spyware companies that develop this stuff are, you know, they have the character that you'd expect of an institution that believes that in its wisdom it knows better than you do what you should be looking at. You know, the majority of them supply primarily to repressive governments and just have a sideline in corporations and schools. Some of them have gone so far, there's one that sells primarily to parents, that's gone so far as to data mine the clickstream and IM sessions and emails of kids and sell them to marketing research firms. So, you know, to me, it's not that much of a stretch to say laptops are used to spy on kids. I call this Chekhov's first law of narrative, right? The gun on the mantelpiece in Act 1 is bound to go off in Act 3. Or you could call it Mitch Kapor's aphorism, architecture is politics. Designing computers to spy on their users means that computers will be used to spy on their users. This doesn't seem like a particularly astute predictive exercise to me, but you can get a lot of mileage out of it in science fiction.
It seems a good point to bring in other aspects of surveillance. There's been, you know, it's taken basically a global financial meltdown for our government to consider not bringing in ID cards in this country. There's been sort of talk of asking university professors to spy on their students.
Are they looking at terroristic documents?
Yeah, that sort of thing.
On the point of spying that's being done here in England, I'd be interested. You've moved from the United States, and I'd like to know what you think of the comparison between the two countries and individuals' rights to privacy in each.
Well, I think in both countries there is a dangerous syllogism that describes the approach to security, which is something must be done. We are doing something, ergo something has been done. So even if no one can explain rationally how you can prevent shoe bombers by x-raying shoes for plastic explosive that doesn't show up on x-rays, the fact that you are x-raying shoes is itself some form of mitigation or mediation for the threat of shoe bombing. I think that the biggest difference between the US and the UK in terms of the way laws are written and passed is that there is a kind of assumption that the gentleman in government and in the civil service will apply laws that are maybe overbroad or badly defined fairly. That you don't need to design law as though it were a security problem. That's the American approach to law, right? It's to approach law as a security problem. You have the problem that authority sometimes leads to abuse. How do you secure yourself against abuse of authority? You do so with a series of kind of layered security, these countermeasures that are meant to check and also reverse abuses, the checks and balances system. And I don't see that as much in evidence in the UK. So there seems to be this idea in the UK that, well, if you've been to Oxford or Cambridge, you just won't use the law in a bad way. That you can be trusted not to do the wrong thing. And that extends down to giving law enforcement discretion under, say, Section 44, that they'll only stop and search people who are really doing something wrong, or the creation of ASBOs, or the creation of curfews in 1,000 British towns and cities for young people, that they'll only be used by law enforcement or community support officers in ways that reflect a kind of consensus judgment about how authority should be exercised here.
I find it really interesting. I was just having this discussion with my husband the other day, who's English, and I was telling him, I suddenly realized that I have no idea what my rights are here, and I know that in the United States, if a cop stops me, he has no right to search me, he has no right to... I don't have to answer any questions, things like that. And my husband was pretty much at a loss to tell me, you know, what I can do. Well, you know, maybe you can do that, but it would probably end badly, mm-hmm. you know, that sort of thing. How have you, are you, do you feel that you're properly educated in your rights here, and do you feel comfortable as a citizen walking around the streets here in that regard?
I find that I have the same conundrum as you. As a Canadian, I had the Charter of Rights and Freedoms to make reference to. In the U.S., obviously, you have the Bill of Rights. Here, you know, I've just done the permanent residency test, and there's a question, I don't know, have you done it?
Not yet.
So there's a question, what sort of constitution does Britain have? And the correct answer is an unwritten one. And I don't know what kind of constitution is an unwritten constitution. And in the book, there's some material about how an unwritten constitution is spread out across a number of documents, starting with a Magna Carta, you know. And it's just, it's like a body of precedent and law and principle, none of which you can put your finger on. You know, like habeas corpus is in the Magna Carta, but it's suspended under you know, the Terrorism Act. So it's, you know, it's not a constitution in the sense of a set of absolute principles that can never be overridden by government. It's a constitution in the Johnny Depp sense of more what you call guidelines.
Yeah, it's sort of contingent on the situation at the time. It's sort of a slightly posher way of making it up as you go along.
Yeah, and you know, like I think zero tolerance sometimes leads to some pretty bad outcomes. So I'm all for letting smart people exercise judgment when it's the right time to do it, but you need some kind of coherent picture of how you're going to stop bad things from happening as a result of the overexercise of this stuff. I guess, you know, so in Canada we have an official policy as regards to language. We are a bilingual nation. We are French and English, and there's never any question. Well, there's in fact lots of questions, but there's always an answer to the question, why is this also in French? Or how many languages should this be in? Or should we spend some money to translate this into French? The answer is always yes, right? The answer is because it's in our Constitution, because it's in the British North America Act, because it's foundational to the nation. The U.S. doesn't have an official language. So the U.S. has this huge panic about Spanish, for example, because it looks like at some point in the future there will probably be more native Spanish speakers or bilingual native Spanish speakers than native English speakers in the nation, right? So more people who are comfortable in Spanish or equally comfortable in Spanish and English than people who are only comfortable in English. And there's this big panic about whether or not English is the language of America, because no one's ever decided what the language is going to be in America. They just kind of had an unspoken default that's being challenged by circumstance. And I think the UK, you see this very much in play in the UK about what is an English value, what is a British value, how does an English value and a Scottish value different? And, you know, I think it's why the BNP gets a lot of mileage, is they make recourse to a set of nebulously defined English values that, because they're not written down anywhere, you can kind of, anyone who shouts loud enough can make claim to being their defender. And so, you know, you might say, well, English values are about tolerance, and that's why England opened its arms to the Huguenots and the Jews who were fleeing persecution during the pogroms. Or you might say English value is about intolerance, and that's why they threw the Jews out and they all had to go to Amsterdam. You know, like there's no one's ever said which of those incidents was the right one and which one actually defines Englishism and how Englishism is different from Britishism.
I want to move us on to some of the internet freedom organizations that you're part of. You're a fellow of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and part of the open rights group over here, but to get us into that, is there some sort of tension between, on the one hand, organising for unfettered freedom of information and stuff on the internet, but at the same time, the issues with privacy and surveillance that we've just been talking about? So people at the moment are perhaps worried that young people are putting too much information about themselves on Facebook and they don't really understand, that, you know, they don't really get the privacy arguments. Do you think that there's some sort of tension there?
You know, there is and there isn't. It was kind of a weaselly answer. So I think that, first of all, we need to distinguish between three different ways that people give their information out. One is that they choose, possibly in a way that is foolish, to give their information to a company or a government. Another is that a government compels them to give that information. And then the third one is the one that's, I think, least understood, which is that the government funds, either directly or indirectly, the creation of large data-gathering private sector entities for whom they are the biggest customer. And so the Credit Reporting Bureau in the U.S., and I think here, fall under that category. In the U.S., the rise of Credit Reporting Bureau is simultaneous with the post-Watergate ban on the FBI gathering data on Americans without particularized suspicion. So the FBI was no longer allowed to just open a file on you because they thought you were an interesting person whom they should have a file on. They had to have a reason to open a file. So they, both through venture backing and also just through brooding it about that they would pay for this service, created the American Credit Reporting Bureau, who have essentially opened files on every American, whom the American intelligence apparatus remains the major customer for, even though there's obviously a lot of private sector customers for them too. So those three cases, I think, are each of them different. I think that the leaving aside the third case, where I think that it's just an end run around the law, and that the lawmakers who told spies, you can't spy on people without suspicion, need to come back to them and say, and that also means you can't pay someone else to spy on them without suspicion too, because I think that That to me seems really clear. It's like, I have a 2-year-old, right? I understand when I say you can't have another cookie, it also means you can't have a cookie now, and it also means you can't ask your mother for a cookie, and it also means you can't go get a cookie for yourself. You can't have another cookie means you can't have another cookie. And like, you know, as the father of a 2-year-old, I understand this, and I think governments should at least be as astute as fathers of 2-year-olds. But the first case of governments gathering information on you without your permission, or compelling you to hand over information, is bad not just in and of itself, because it's unduly invasive, but also because I think it systematically disorders our intuition about the value of our private information. In the same way that if you create a lottery, and, you know, the American Lottery slogan is, you've got to be in it to win it, which is about the most enumerate statement you can make, because actually being in it doesn't materially, if you were a statistician, you would say whether or not you're in it, you're not going to win it, in the same way that you're also not going to be hit by lightning or a meteor. I mean, some people are hit by lightning strikes and meteor, but no one actually makes any kind of plans for what to do in that contingency, because the probability is so low that there's no reason to think about it. But by creating lotteries and telling people you've got to be in it to win it, I think we systematically disorder their ability to understand probability and risk. In the same way, when you create systems that compel people to hand over their personal information, you systematically cause them to undervalue that information and to misunderstand the potential consequences of giving it out. When you blithely say, oh, we're going to gather all this personal information in this, you know, kind of these centralized databases, and it just won't leak because it's a solvable problem to keep this information from leaking, you cause people to believe that the private sector will avail itself of whatever magic beans the government claims it has access to stop information from leaking, and that there is some way that you can kind of concentrate this diffuse, relatively harmless atoms of kind of private information into the super concentrated, infinitely long-lived, and pluripotent kind of information plutonium, where you've gathered all this information together and you know, it now can be kind of weaponized with relative ease and simplicity, and that somehow that's containable. And so I think that that's the yes and no answer. The yes and no answer is, I wish people wouldn't give as much money to the private sector, and I think the way that we start getting them to revalue their personal information is to change how the public sector demands and compels their information disclosure.
What about, I think this falls into your second point of those three examples, that something like Facebook, which of course is, you know, is a private entity, mm-hmm. but people are freely giving their information because it's fun, but are then, in some respects, unaware of what that information then goes on to be used for.
So there's an extent to which every game is essentially a Skinner box. It's a behaviorist experiment that using reward and negative reward, that's withholding a reward, or even sometimes punishment, to condition people to do stuff. And that's great, and it's terrible sometimes too. And Facebook is a game. I think you said you're right. It's fun. It's a game. It's got a game mechanic. And there's no obvious reason to me why you couldn't design a game mechanic that rewarded people for social play that revolved around not disclosing, right? That revolved around keeping things private. There is a I think, a false equivalence between social and disclosure. There's some disclosure necessary for social activity, but some of our most enduring and fun game-like social institutions, like the Freemasons, are built entirely around non-disclosure, not around disclosure, right? So I think that, like, in some Paleolithic moment in the history of social software, maybe it was like when Six Degrees, which I think was probably the first of these social networks, came about, someone sat down and kind of flipped a coin and came up with a disclosure game instead of a secrecy game. And that was successful, and so the successors to it came along and said, well, what variants can we make on the successful case that will be more successful? How can we pursue this towards a maximum? And they've reached, I think, a local maximum around rewarding people for disclosure. And I think that there's no reason why someone couldn't both financially and politically make a success out of a non-disclosure game. In fact, I think that given how much competition there is in the disclosure game space, that the non-disclosure game space, by being relatively untapped, probably has a lot of money waiting to be extracted from it. There's a lot of value for a smart entrepreneur. It's, you know, Brian Eno said that the genius lies in not doing the thing that no one else has not done before. You know, and there's probably that opportunity lurking out there for some smart entrepreneur who wants to design that game.
But that's not going to be a boing boing offshoot anytime soon.
It's possible, but not likely. Institutionally, boing boing is both blessed and crippled by the fact that it doesn't really have much by way of an institution. So we have almost no overheads. I mean, we have a managing editor now who's brilliant, Rob Biskitza, who's actually British but lives in Pittsburgh. We've got this kind of Atlantic swap that we've done. You know, we hadn't actually all been in the same room together for the first 6 years, like, ever. We do, like, 9 phone calls a year, if that. Probably more like 5. 1 face-to-face in an average year. You know, we don't have an office. Someone helped me yesterday to find out what the main switchboard number was for Boing Boing. It's like, you know, if that question is so wrong, it's not even wrong, right? Like, it's in another dimension of wrong. It's infra wrong. It can't. Its wrongness cannot be detected with unaided sensory apparatus. So that's great, because it means that virtually every penny we bring in is profit. It means that we spend almost no time discussing what to do, and almost all of our time doing stuff. It does, however, mean that things that require a lot of discussion in order to make them happen don't happen very often at Boing Boing. It's pretty heroic when they happen, because you have to overcome a lot of the institutional inertia. And I think that that's you know, talking about local maxima and trying to find build on successes, I think that as an institution, Boing Boing has really pushed past the limits of what most people believed an institution without a formally constituted center could attain. You know, like, how much can you do without meetings? I think Boing Boing's gone blown past what most people thought you could do without meetings. But I think we're also coming up against some limits. So, you know, we have done some pretty cool things in the last couple of months that require a higher level of institutional support. Like, we've got this Boing Boing Bazaar that's now part of the Maker's Market and so on. Largely due to our heroic managing editor and to one of my partners, David Peskovitz, who's actually drawing a little extra money out of the partner dispersals to do just management stuff. But even so, we don't do much as an institution compared to other institutions of our turnover. On the other hand, we don't spend much on institutional expenses compared to other institutions of our turnover.
Do you think that Boing Boing presents an ideal model for other blogs, for other media outlets that
want to... I think Boing Boing presents an ideal model for organizations like Boing Boing. but yeah, I don't think there is one ideal. I do think, though, that if you know, we have this digital economy bill pending here, and if you want to look at what a business in the digital economy looks like, it's a business that doesn't have much center there. It's a business that basically exploits the low cost of organizing that's enabled by the internet to build institutions that turn over less income overall, but keep a much higher proportion of it as profit. So it looks a lot less like a giant label that spends $50 million a year, or £50 million a year, to make £80 million a year, and looks a lot more like a business that spends, these aren't Boing Boing's numbers, £5,000 a year to make £2 million a year. And, you know, the profit-to-earnings ratio there is vastly better. It's the size is probably capped, but it means that you get a lot more small traders, small, medium-sized enterprises. And I think those are actually characteristic of a digital economy. And I think that businesses that are essentially built on the fact that they can spend more on organizing than everyone else are actually characteristic of the analog economy. That is the analog economy in a nutshell. It's marshaling more resources in one place. It's like throwing more precious goods into the potlatch fire than anyone else, in order to kind of outspend all of your competition. And that's what the labels have done, right? They've built these vast distribution chains, these vast institutions that are more expensive than any other entrant in the market can make. They occasionally churn out a statistically insignificant billionaire, in terms of statistically insignificant in terms of the number of acts that want to go out and produce music. And then they don't do anything else for almost everyone else. And the fact that Mandelson is committed to preserving these in the digital economy is like somewhat charming, in as much as it's like, you know, the pro blacksmith act of the early automobile era. But on the other hand, it's completely a doomed exercise. And more importantly, you know, the automobile gave us some important freedoms. The internet gives us way more freedoms than that. Clay Shirky says it's the one wire that delivers freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and freedom of assembly directly into your home. And we're talking about crippling those freedoms in order to, you know, make sure that blacksmiths will be shoeing horses well into the 28th century, no matter how many jetpacks we're flying around in.
You're listening to Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny, and Rebecca Watson this week, and we're talking to Cory Doctorow. So, Cory, let's bring in the word copyright then. Let's talk about copyright and basically what's the issue with copyright.
Well, I guess there isn't an issue with copyright as traditionally considered, right? Copyright is a system for regulating the supply chain of the entertainment industry. I mean, it's got some problems with it as an artist. I kind of wish that it was tilted a little more towards my favor than giant institutional investor favor. But, you know, it's not a terrible system. I just think it's not a very good system for regulating everything we do that involves copying, just because copying is a central feature of the entertainment industry. So, like, you want to create a regulation for the entertainment, for regulating the supply chain of the entertainment industry. You have to figure out in law who falls under that regulation. Well, you go, okay, well, if you're copying a creative work, you're part of the entertainment industry. And that makes a certain amount of sense because, you know, if you're copying a record, you've got a factory. If you're copying a book, you've got a publishing house. That's no longer true, right? Copying this reified act that used to be a good heuristic for figuring out whether or not someone's doing something industrial is now something we do 10,000 times before breakfast. And so that big unwieldy regulation that requires talented, trained copyright lawyers to make sense of it and ensure that it's being followed no longer fits or never fit and will never fit things that people do among themselves, things that people do in respect of the artists that they love, so fan fiction or Harry Potter, you know, fan art, or lending a mate some music or giving a mate some music. None of those things should be encompassed in copyright's rules. It doesn't mean that there shouldn't be rules for them, but the 12-year-old who wants to make a Harry Potter fan site isn't going to be able to follow copyright in the same way that the Universal Studios lawyer who wants to make an unauthorized Harry Potter joke book is going to be able to. And anyone who argues otherwise is crazy. You know, as someone who actually relies on a sensible, coherent copyright to regulate my interactions with the people who pay me money, which is, you know, publishers and their supply chain, I don't want it diluted and stretched in all these crazy ways to cover all these interactions that it has no place being inserted into, because I think that makes it nonsense. I think that you tell a 12-year-old copyright means that you can't make your unauthorized Harry Potter website, or that, you know, you do so at your peril, and that 12-year-old concludes that copyright is bankrupt and she doesn't need to pay any attention to it. As someone who wants people to pay attention to copyright when it affects my fortunes, I don't want that to happen.
You mentioned in the first half Mandelson's method of sort of dealing with people who are file sharing, which is cutting off internet access. And over the last few years, I've seen something remarkable in that the music industry has seemingly gone out of its way to alienate its own customers. I mean, this is unprecedented.
Well, it's not the music industry per se, it's the record industry. Yeah. Actually, funny, because another piece of the music industry, the live performance industry, had its best year in history last year. And given that live performance fees go directly to artists instead of being filtered through the record label in the form of royalty, it means that last year was the best year ever for musicians in the history of the world. It was just not the best year ever for recording musicians. So I do think it's unprecedented. I can't think of another business that thinks that suing or, you know, fighting your customers is good business. I mean, I guess maybe the phone companies spring to mind as a kind of template for this. And it's funny, I look at Apple, who have built their business around pleasing both the phone companies and the record companies, and who then claim, well, it's not our fault that all these terrible things have happened, it's our business partners with whom we climbed into bed all knowing. I mean, you know, they have lain down with the dogs, and then they expect us to excuse them for having woken up with fleas. I guess that is pretty odd. The Mandelson thing, I want to correct you slightly. Mandelson is not proposing to disconnect people who break copyright. Mandelson is proposing to disconnect the families of people who are accused of breaking copyright. It's actually vastly worse than disconnecting people who break copyright, because at least that represents someone who's committed an infraction, who's then been found guilty of that infraction by a court, who is then paying a penalty themselves. Whether or not you agree that it's proportionate, I don't think it is. I think, you know, cutting someone off from the entire information society because they took some music without paying for it. I mean, if only we could limit the penalties for downloading a CD to the penalties that you would pay for shoplifting a CD, which are, you know, a slap on the wrist and a little fine. That would be a huge advance on the penalty that we're actually proposing here. But Mandelson is proposing much worse. He's proposing collective punishment, something that's outlawed in the Geneva Conventions, where entire households that simply have one member who's been accused without proof of having infringed copyright no longer get to participate in the information society, even as number 10 is saying, we're going to move all government services online. If you're not online, you won't be able to be a member of British society. You won't be able to participate in civics, because that's the way that everything's going. We're going to take those people and take them out of British society.
I believe that there's actually a big rally going on today about
the
bill.
That's right, yeah, I'm going
down. Oh, are you? That's basically what I was going to ask, is if you feel that you're a political player, considering that you have a vested interest as an author, and you have very strong opinions, and you have a huge audience. So do you feel that it's almost your duty to go out there and fight for these things?
Well, I don't know if that's what... I don't know if I feel that way. I don't think it's my duty per se, or that it's like, because when you have a big enough megaphone, you are required to use it in certain ways. I'm leery of allowing other people to write checks that I'm expected to cash. But that said, I've been an activist my whole life, and I would do this regardless of how many people read my blog. I'd be out at this demonstration. You know, I was arrested when I was 12 with my father blockading people who make cruise missile guidance systems. You know, when I was 5 and they told me I was going to march at my aunt's wedding, they asked me if I knew how to march, and I said, well, of course. And I walked up and down, miming that I was carrying a placard shouting, not the church and not the state, women must control their fate. The first picture of me ever published in the newspaper was a picture of Dr. Henry Morgenthaler, Canada's abortion doctor, who performed abortions when they were unlawful, and criminal trials eventually led to the legalization of abortion, holding me aloft at a benefit dinner. So I would be doing this regardless. I'm not doing it out of a sense of duty. I'm doing it out of a sense of urgency.
Right. And on the same topic of political action, I just came yesterday. I was at another rally for libel reform. And I haven't seen you. I don't think I've seen much on Boing Boing and whatnot about libel reform here in England. I was wondering if you had an opinion on...
Oh, we covered the Simon Singh thing.
Okay.
Yeah, we did. And certainly, we've defended a couple of libel claims this year, most notably a company called Magic Jack, who make a USB device you plug into your computer, and then you can plug a phone into it and make phone calls. And they have terrible terms of service that allow them to spy on you in order to figure out what to advertise to you while you're on the phone. And they also, they had this ridiculous thing where they had the number of Magic Jack users on their homepage, and every time you hit reload, it just added between 0 and 5 to that number. So it's just like a made-up number. And we published this, and they sued us for libel. And we won, but we spent $70,000 defending the case. Now, most of it we got back in fees, and some of it came back in insurance, and the rest we got back by selling an ad to one of their competitors when we finally published about the thing. And I've often wondered whether we can't find in the U.S. a business model for this, where when companies accuse us of libeling them, we make fun of them, and we sell advertisements to their competitors, and we use that to recoup the legal costs associated with companies that bring these groundless libel suits. I mean, Ralph Lauren threatened to sue us this year for...
the Photoshop.
For a Photoshopped skinny model, and we've had others threaten to sue us as well. And you know, these are like monster traffic generators. So I think that, you know, if one way that maybe you could balance the British libel system, which a lawyer here who specializes in libel once told me, the thing you need to understand about the libel system is that it was generated by MPs to allow them to sue newspapers that say bad things about them. Is that one way that you could fix this is maybe with something like the SLAPP statutes in California, strategic litigation against public participation, which allows someone who's been accused of libel to file a preliminary motion before a court that says, I believe that the person who has sued me has done so in order to shut me up. And because not because I'm saying something libelous, but because they want to outspend me. And the court can examine that motion on its face, and if they find that it has merit, they can dismiss the case immediately and award up to 100% of the costs to the person who's been accused of libel. Now, you still have to be willing to front a lot of money. I mean, our firm, our law firm, fronted us $70,000 in legal fees on the way to us getting this judgment in our favor. So you either need to have a firm who's willing to float you that, or an insurance company, or you need to have deep pockets, or you need a system that allows lawyers to work on contingency. But at very least, this puts a certain fear into people who would bring frivolous libel suits, because you've got a firm on the one hand just ringing up the charges, you know, $70,000 for filing a bunch of motions, and on the other hand, you've got the possibility that you're going to have to pay out those charges and face the public humiliation that arises from the publicity splash that says, you know, you brought a case that has been determined by the courts to be just bullying, and you had to, you know, cough up 70,000 quid to some, you know, city firm by way of punishment. You know, you have to pay for the person who you were initially accused. So I think that's not, you know, not the worst answer, although I think more comprehensive reform would be even better.
Just to finish up then, there's just one other topic I wanted to cover. I wanted to sort of gauge your opinion on the idea of the patenting of information, and I'm thinking here particularly of things like, you know, the Human Genome Project. And
Well, in particular, the human genome is an interesting example because it hinges on notions of what is a legitimate claim to ownership.
Yeah, ownership of your own genome, mm-hmm. basically.
And I think that the problem with this is that we get caught up in what Professor James Boyle at Duke calls property talk. And property, there's nothing wrong with property. I support property. I think it's nice that we can own things. But I think that property is a bad organizing metaphor for information and for lots of other things, right? So I have a 2-year-old. I don't own her. She's not my property. She is mine, however, in some meaningful sense. If you were to, God forbid, kill her, the crime wouldn't be theft of daughter. The crime would be murder, right? So it doesn't mean that if you don't own something, that your interest in it isn't substantial and important. We wouldn't say that murder is less important than theft, but it means that property sometimes is just the wrong way to think about it. So think about your mobile phone number, right? It's not your property. It's a string of digits. On the other hand, you have an important and significant interest in your phone number. You have an interest, first of all, in your mobile carrier not handing it off to someone else, especially after you've sunk a lot of money printing up business cards that have the number on it. You have an interest in it not being spray painted on a bathroom wall for a good time call. You have a number of interests in it. I think that genomes fall into this category of things that we have interests in that are not our property. You didn't make your genes. They are not your creation. They're not even your parents' creation. They are instead something that is part of our species-wide heritage. So this brings us to once we stop talking about property and the innate right that we have to the things that are ours, we can start looking at policy as a lever for creating good outcomes. So we can say, well, what do we want out of our patent system? Historically, the patent system has had two functions. One is to give people exclusive rights that they can use to drum up capital. And the other one is to give people exclusive rights that they can enforce even if they disclose the workings, so that other practitioners can examine their invention, because the workings have been disclosed and widely disseminated, and come up with their own inventions that may be based on it or inspired by it. Are either of those things best served by patenting genes or by excluding genes from patenting? I think that's the important question. Not does some person who sequences a genome own it, or not does the person whose genome has been sequenced own it, because neither of those things tell you anything useful about whether or not you're going to get better genetic technology for us as a species out of our species-wide heritage, but rather these other questions. And I suspect it's a case-by-case thing. I think that there are probably certain kinds, so I'm not a geneticist, I think there are probably certain kinds of genetic activity or genetic research where an exclusive rights regime would, first of all, get you capital that you couldn't get elsewhere, and second of all, produce disclosures that other people would be able to use to do their own research and to improve the pool of knowledge. And I think there are other ones where we don't need it at all. And it's not always obvious which one is which. I think, you know, Sir John Salston, with his Human Genome Project, transcended what most people thought you could do without a set of exclusive rights. But I think that as a start, getting people who are actual geneticists in the room and figuring out which fields of endeavor within genetics a set of exclusive rights makes sense for in terms of achieving those policy goals, and how long those exclusive rights should be in order to maximize those policy goals, is 20 years the right period, right? Would you get more if you got 10 years? I remember someone telling me a story about talking to the chief software architect at Microsoft before Bill Gates, I forget who that was, and saying, how many lines of code would you write, how many more lines of code would Microsoft write if copyright went from 90 years for your corporate copyrights to 120? And he said, well, zero, right? We write all the lines of code that we can and all the hours that God sends, right? And he said, well, how many fewer lines of code would you write if you only got 10 years of copyright? And he thought about it and he said, you know, to be honest, we'd write the same number of lines of code. So from a policy perspective, it seems like the right number of years to give Microsoft for its code is between 0 and 10, because the years beyond that aren't producing the incentive to generate more lines of code or, you know, more investment. So I think that's the kind of question we should be asking, and that property talk just clouds our judgment.
It's a perfect point for us to end on.
Thank you so much, Corey.
Well, thank you, guys.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.